Kloppenberg, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin. Ms. Kloppenberg.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General Joanne Kloppenberg, and I appear for the plaintiff's state of Wisconsin. I will begin with a brief synopsis of the case. The city of Oak Creek filled a creek with concrete without a permit and after being informed by the DNR that it needed a permit. After 5 days of hearings, an administrative law judge found and the Court of Appeals later affirmed that the city's concrete channelization of the creek so harmed the creek's fisheries and wildlife values, the aquatic habitat, and the water quality as to threaten the entire riverine system of which the creek is a part, and could neither be permitted nor left in place. The Attorney General filed this action to require the city to remove the concrete and to restore the creek, to undo what the administrative law judge and the Court of Appeals had found was a violation of Sections 3012 and 3019 and a threat to the river system of great value. Under Section 30.294, every violation of Chapter 30 is a public nuisance that any person may seek to abate through legal action. A section that this court held last year in Gillen versus Nina gives any person standing to seek injunctive relief. And it is under Section 30.294 that the Attorney General brought this action to abate and enjoin this particular public nuisance. In 1996, after the Court of Appeals affirmed that the city had, since 1985, violated Chapter 30, the legislature, without any public hearing, passed a bill exempting the creek from Chapter 30 protections. The Attorney General argued in support of his public nuisance claim against these violations that that bill is null and void because it violates the public trust and other constitutional precepts. The Attorney General also claimed that the city's concrete channelization is a common law public nuisance based on the facts that had been found in the earlier court proceedings. The Circuit Court found that the concrete channelization of the creek is a statutory and public and common law public nuisance, that Section 30.056 is unconstitutional as a violation of the public trust, the local bill prohibition, and equal protection, and that the Attorney General has standing to bring this action and raise the constitutional challenge in support of his public nuisance claim because that claim is founded on and alleges a violation of the public trust, and the violation of the public trust is an issue of great public concern and involves injury to the polity. The Circuit Court focused on the unlikelihood that a private citizen could sue and on the significance of the public trust. The Court of Appeals reversed, based on what the dissent characterized as a contrived misreading of only one case, Public Intervenor versus DNR, and never mentioned the public trust concerns that underlie this action. The state urges this court to adopt the Circuit Court's approach and to reverse the Court of Appeals. To do so, the state asks this court to make two rulings. First, we ask the court to rule that where the Attorney General has standing to bring an action, and the constitutionality of a statute is at issue, the Attorney General can raise that issue. The second rule is that whenever a constitutional challenge that is made in a properly brought cause of action raises an issue of great public concern, that challenge may be heard, regardless who makes it. Both of these rules have been followed by this court, but have never been stated.
How do they differ? I mean, I know one is specific, one is general, but it sounds like one incorporates the other, or is subsumed under the other.
The latter is more general and subsumes the standing of the Attorney General. In this case, there seem to be challenges to both propositions.
I mean, if we grant number two, then doesn't number one necessarily follow?
Yes, I agree that that is true. To grant number two, you need to go through all of the great issue of great public concern cases, and I will turn to those.
Ms. Kloppenberg, before you do that,
sure.
let me direct you a little bit differently.
Okay.
Do you view this particular case as a case that involves separation of powers issues?
No, I do not. I believe that this case involves this court's duty to interpret the Constitution and to protect, to prevent the legislature from violating the Constitution.
Well, why is that not a separation of powers case? If we're looking at the authority of the executive branch on one side, that branch specifically in this case being represented by the Attorney General, and we look at the powers of the legislature on the other side, and it's my understanding that the legislature acted not once but twice in regard to this matter. Why isn't that then presented as a separation of powers case?
Because the legislature cannot act unconstrained by the Constitution. The democratic process with a small d cannot save an unconstitutional act. The special interest can no more obtain from the legislature a law that, say, provides that a municipality so many miles from a class one city can exclude non-white commuters or residents, then special interests can ask the legislature to pass a law that allows activity in a waterway that violates the public trust.
I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead and finish.
I just wanted to ask,
in the same vein, because the Constitution says that the Attorney General's job is to uphold the for example, legislature passes a statute, it's your job to uphold that statute. Would this be better left, and maybe this is a policy question, to an individual, some private group, or somebody that's been harmed by this concrete of a quarter mile of a river?
I have a two-part answer to that. The second will be the statutory authority the Attorney General has, even given that he's also supposed to defend statutes. I'll get to that second. First, there are alternatives. Those alternatives include a private party bringing suit, or the or the Attorney General coming to this court and seeking original jurisdiction, or making a common law nuisance claim. There are significant problems that are related to all three of those alternatives, and they have to do with the increasing number of special interest bills. There were two in the 1997 budget bill. There were three in the budget bill that recently came out of committee in the last 2 days, and I can describe those later if I have time. One of those is precisely like this case. It overturns a finding by an administrative law judge that upheld a DNR denial of a permit to dredge a creek. So the number of bills is increasing. There is a much greater burden and expense of making the showing necessary to get injunctive relief when the activity has yet to commence. And there, when you're a private party, there may be a need to post bond. And there is a need for significant expert and technical fact-finding. Specifically, original jurisdiction and suits by private parties. Here, the violation and harm have already taken place and been established. However, as in these other special interest bills that have recently surfaced, what about where a building is about to be constructed on lake bed, or a mega marina is about to be constructed in the water, or wetlands are about to be filled, or a creek is about to be dredged as soon as the bill allowing that activity is signed? Then the burden increases substantially to make the technical, fact-intensive, and expert-intensive showing necessary for injunctive relief to prevent harm. That's expensive for private parties. And it also mires this court in fact-finding that is usually left to the circuit courts.
Well, if the legislature says it's okay to fill that creek, why isn't that at least a modification of Chapter 30 and says, for this creek, it's not a public nuisance?
Because Chapter 30 is a codification of the common law public trust protections. To circumvent those protections and without applying those standards say that a creek can be filled is akin to redefining the public trust. In City versus Byrne versus Flores, 521 U.S. 507, the United States Supreme Court rejected Congress's redefinition of the 14th Amendment right to freedom of religion. The court said that if Congress could alter the 14th Amendment's meaning then the Constitution would be reduced to an ordinary legislative act, alterable at the legislature's will. The legislature cannot change what a constitutional right is. Similarly, the legislature here cannot alter the common law public trust right that emanates from the Constitution, from the forever free clause.
So it's a constitutional concept, you're saying?
Correct, yes.
Now, did any court hold that this creek could not have concrete in it?
Yes, the Court of Appeals.
And after that, the legislature changed the law?
Correct. Well, the legislature changed the law before the Court of Appeals ruled, and then that law was invalidated as a local bill because it was in the budget bill, and then the identical version of the bill was attached to a floodplain zoning bill after the Court of Appeals.
So the bill presently before us, the law presently before us, is a law that changes a decision of a court. Is that right?
Yes, it does.
Well, one time when I was doing research, I found that there were a series of cases that said that the legislature can change a law prospectively, but can't go back and change a decision of a court. Are you familiar with that line of cases?
I'm not. I'm familiar with the general concept that the legislature can and does pass laws that change court judicial decisions.
In the future.
Correct.
But this one changes them retrospectively, retroactively.
That is true. That's right.
I just have one question.
Sure.
You're talking about if Chief Justice asked you if had any court determined that. You said the Court of Appeals. I thought maybe I've got my cases used. Was the Court of Appeals rather?
Correct. The Circuit Court first affirmed the administrative law judge's decision and also ruled the budget bill provision was unconstitutional.
Right.
That went up to the Court of Appeals, and in a published decision, the Court of Appeals affirmed.
Then the statute was changed.
Right. Okay. The statute was changed and we started all over again.
They affirmed on the ground that it was a public or
a local bill,
correct? They didn't
correct.
Affirm on the Constitution.
No, they didn't reach the other grounds. The what has taken place here, this creek may be unique, but as I alluded to earlier, the situation is not unique. If the court prevents the Attorney General from raising a constitutional challenge where the Attorney General has standing to do so, and that standing comes from both the public trust and 30.294, then the effect would be to sanction end runs through the legislature around agency decisions that prohibit or reject what the Constitution does not allow. In the 1997 budget bill, there were at least two provisions inserted without any hearing to remove public trust protections from Big Silver Lake. And that challenge to those provisions is pending before the Court of Appeals now. In the current budget bill, there are at least three provisions that carve out special interests from public trust protection. One, as I alluded to earlier, seeks to circumvent the result of a contested case hearing where an administrative law judge upheld the DNR's denial of a permit to dredge a creek by exempting that creek from Chapter 30 jurisdiction. Two other provisions seek to circumvent DNR's denial of approval to fill large and valuable wetlands to maximize profits at two projects in two specific locations. These are not partisan matters. They all cross party lines. To disallow the Attorney General's constitutional challenge in this case would give special interests carte blanche to go around the administrative and statutory processes that enforce constitutional standards by using political pressure to get what the Constitution does not allow. The Attorney General, in addition to having standing, which is not really disputed, also has statutory authority to bring this action. First, under Section 30.294, but also under a combination of 165.25 sub 9 and 19.01. 165.25 sub 9 says that the Department of Justice shall perform all other duties imposed by law. Section Section 19.01 imposes a duty through the oath to support the Constitution. So that goes a little bit to Justice Wilcox's concern about whether the Attorney General can only defend the constitutionality of statutes. The more general statement of the rule brings into play the line of cases that addresses this, the rule that bars constitutional challenges in cases between municipalities and or state agencies and officers, the issue of great public concern exception to that rule, and the private litigant limitation on that exception. The cases that state various versions of this rule, the exception and the limitation, are inconsistent and unclear. In Fulton, in 1961, this court set out the rule and the issue of great public concern exception, and on rehearing elaborated that the state must be allowed to raise its challenge because a private party is not likely to do so. This statement of the rule and exception was followed in three other cases. Unified School District No. 1 of Racine County versus Work in 1977, City of Madison versus Ayers and Diller in 1978, and a Court of Appeals case in 1982, Milwaukee County versus District Council 48. There are also cases that didn't follow that statement of the rule and exception. The exception was seemingly dropped in Columbia County, 1962 case, though the holding there applies only to suits by counties against state agencies. And the private litigant limitation, which was not in Fulton, was added in other cases, two of which seem to use the limitation to extinguish the issue of great public concern exception, contrary to Fulton. One is a Court of Appeals case, S.C. Johnson, where the court makes the no challenge rule absolute whenever the state is a party, and State Ex Rel Lacrosse versus Rothwell, when this court in 1964 stated that a private litigant was necessary for the issue of great public concern exception to apply, but on rehearing suggested that no exception was necessary in any case where private parties are present. The only case in which the court has prevented the state from raising a constitutional challenge is the per curiam decision in Eau Claire, 1974. There, the court just stated the rule without the exception, but that's presumably because the case did not raise an issue of great public concern. It related to a joint sewerage matter. As this court has recognized in Fulton, the rationale for distinguishing between cases with and without private parties doesn't hold up. The issue of great public concern exception is needed precisely because private citizens are unlikely to sue for the reasons of cost, the need for experts, and a very fact and technical extensive showing, because of the number of bills, because of the bond requirement, because there's no fee-shifting requirement to encourage citizen suits. The upshot is the cases do not provide a clear directive. For the reasons recognized in Fulton, the state asked this court to establish as a rule that were what all the cases have nevertheless done. All of these cases, except Eau Claire, have considered the constitutional challenge. And so we ask that you confirm that the rule is to allow a constitutional challenge to be heard wherever that challenge raises an issue of great public concern. Only one of the cases involving constitutional challenges in suits between state agencies or between state agencies and municipalities involves the public trust, and that's the very old 1875 case, the Attorney General versus the City of Eau Claire. In that case, the court did not mention either the general rule prohibiting such challenges or the exceptions that allow them, but the court did state that the state's abdication of its charge of public waters is not a matter of degree and is the court's duty to prevent. The special weight and significance of the public trust was reaffirmed just last year in Gillen versus Nina, which leads me to the public trust violation alleged here, which has been extensively briefed, so I'll only make one or two additional points. And that is, as I noted before, and as this court has stated in Trudeau, Gillen, and Hickson, Chapter 30 codifies the common law public trust protections, the definition of the constitutional right to the forever free waters of the state. To take this stretch of the creek out of Chapter 30 is an irreconcilable conflict with the public trust doctrine. The Court of Appeals found as much in Cassidy versus DNR, 132 with second 153, when it barred a sewerage district from channeling streams without Chapter 30 permits. The public trust is also akin to the right of equal representation. In Reynolds versus Zimmerman, the court characterized the equal representation rights, the violation of those rights, and malapportionment as an injury to the polity. In 1892, in Attorney General versus Cunningham, Justice Kinney equated public trust rights with equal representation rights. Public trust rights, like the right to equal representation, is simply just too big for one person to get his or her arms around, and involves a right of sovereignty, a right to the polity, and constitutes an issue of great public concern. Finally, this court does not need to overrule Public Intervenor versus DNR in order to affirm the circuit court in this case. Public Intervenor should be limited to its facts, which are a suit brought by a legislative creation, plaintiff Public Intervenor, which the public intervener had no statutory authority to bring, and where the public intervener suffered no injury. That case has no application here to this suit, which is brought by a constitutional officer, which the officer has statutory authority to bring, and where the injury has been established by statute and case law.
What was the last thing that you said, and the injury?
Where the injury, I'm sorry, has been established by statute and case law.
So what do you expect from this court? What do you want this court to do?
What I want the court to do is to reverse the Court of Appeals and to find that the Attorney General has both the standing and statutory authority to bring this action, and therefore the constitutional challenge he raises in support of that action may be heard.
Okay, does it have to go back? Or do we make a finding that there's a public nuisance here? Court of the Circuit Court good enough on this?
The questions of law with respect to the statute, the questions with respect to the statutory public nuisance claim are all questions of law and could be decided by this court or by the Court of Appeals. The common law public nuisance claim need only be reached if no statutory public nuisance is found.
Could I ask, is every challenge to the constitutionality of a statute a matter of great public interest?
No, it is not. For example, the city of Eau Claire case, in which the state DNR wanted to challenge the constitutionality of a provision relating to joint sewerage districts, did not have much of an impact beyond the parties, the administrative decision that was at stake in that case, and would not be an issue of great public concern. There is one case, I believe it may have been a Court of Appeals case, where the issue had to do with workers' compensation, the retroactivity of some kind of workers' compensation law, and the class was determined to include only two people, and so the court held that was not an issue of great public concern.
I want to make sure I understand. Suppose the Attorney General felt that some provision of truth and sentencing law was unconstitutional and tried to go into court to declare that unconstitutional. What is the source of authority to do that? So certainly that's broad.
That I don't know.
You don't know.
I'm not familiar with the Attorney General's statutory authority with respect to criminal law. I can only say that in this case, with respect to the public trust, there is statutory authority.
That's the nuisance?
30.294, but also the combination of statutes which might apply depending on the constitutional violation alleged in a truth in sentencing case, the combination of 126.25 sub 9 with 19.01.
Which means what?
Which means that...
What are those things that you're talking about?
Okay. That the Department of Justice also has all other duties imposed by law, and supporting the Constitution is one of those duties. Whether the challenge that would be made is an issue of great public concern would be for the court to determine.
Why wouldn't that combination apply to the case up in the Northwest, Eau Claire, or whatever they just referenced?
That provides the statutory authority. The standing would be if there's an issue of great public concern.
Does the Attorney General, we have held that the Attorney General has a duty to defend the constitutionality of statutes. Does the Attorney General have a duty to defend the constitutionality of a statute he or she believes to be unconstitutional?
The duty of the Attorney General, as I understand it, is to defend the state when there is a legal argument that can be made. If the Attorney General believes there's no legal argument that can be made to defend the constitutionality of a statute, then the Attorney General's obligation is to defend the Constitution from that statute, as the Attorney General did in Thompson v. Craney and other cases cited in the footnotes in the brief.
Any questions? Follow-up. If the Attorney General has the authority to challenge the constitutionality of a statute, who does the Attorney General serve?
The state.
Himself?
Yes.
But don't the statute say that the Attorney General has to be served?
Yes, and in fact, in cases that I have brought, I have served the Attorney General.
Thank you, Ms. Kloppenberg. Mr. Haskell, representing the city of Oak Creek.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. Chief Justice Abramson, members of the court. My name is Lawrence Haskin. I'm the city attorney for Oak Creek. I intend on making three major points in my argument this afternoon. First, that the Attorney General lacks the authority to challenge the constitutionality of Section 30.056 in this case, based upon a long line of cases culminating in the public intervener case. I also intend to discuss the dissent in that case. Secondly, that there is no legal basis for the Attorney General to bring an action in this case under Section 30.294. And finally, I'd like to discuss the practical implications that would arise if this court changed the law and granted the Attorney General the authority to challenge the constitutionality of a statute in circuit court without direction from the governor, the state legislature, or a state agency. I do not intend to cover the constitutional issues of public trust, equal protection, the local bill. I believe that those issues have been adequately briefed, and I don't believe that the court needs to address those issues if it rules in our favor on the basic issue, which is the Attorney General's authority to challenge the constitutionality of the statute. In the public intervener case, the Attorney General wrote in his Supreme Court brief, "Nowhere is there a statutory provision giving the Attorney General or his assistants the power to challenge the constitutionality of a law or rule of this state or one of its agencies." He was right, and the court agreed with him. And now he's changed his position 180 degrees. Why has he changed his position? We've raised that issue in each of the briefs that we filed in this case, and the Attorney General has never addressed that question. Nothing has changed fundamentally with respect to the rule that was established in the public intervener case. That case has not been overruled, and Section 165.25 has not been changed to give the Attorney General authority to challenge the constitutionality of statute under these circumstances. The Attorney General is an office created by the Constitution with its duties prescribed by law. And 100 years of cases have told us that prescribed by law in Wisconsin means authority given to it by the legislature. It does not derive its authority from the common law. And that is why this concept of the core constitutional function that the Attorney General raises in his brief has no applicability here. There is no such legal theory. The case law that has developed regarding the Attorney General's authority has never mentioned that theory. There is nothing in the statutes that gives the Attorney General this core constitutional function to challenge the constitutionality of an act. And I'd also just like to say, and I'll get back to it hopefully a little bit later, the great public concern doctrine is really a red herring. That is a theory of law developed as common law. As Ms. Kloppenberg said, in the Fulton case, it is a common law theory. It has absolutely no applicability to the Attorney General. There are no cases that discuss the great public concern doctrine that have anything to do with the Attorney General in terms of they being a party. So there is no applicability there. With respect to the dissent in the public intervener case, I believe the dissent's position and our position are harmonized very easily. Where the majority and the dissent, as I read the case, parted company was that the majority analyzed the public intervener as an assistant attorney general and said, as an assistant attorney general, there is no authority to challenge the constitutionality. The dissent, on the other hand, looked at the public intervener as a creature of the legislature and looked at the intent that the legislature had in adopting the statute that created the public intervener's position, and said that the public intervener was created as an adversarial force with respect to environmental matters, and that the legislature must have intended to give to the public intervener, as a public intervener, the authority to challenge the constitutionality of an act. It was looking at the intent of the legislature. And that's what I believe that the court ought to do here, and say that the legislature gives the Attorney General its authority to act. The authority prescribed by law did not give the Attorney General the authority to unilaterally, on its own, commence an action in circuit court to challenge the acts of the legislature which prescribes its duties.
Well, how far can the legislature go in taking and saying the AG doesn't have powers? Can it say it doesn't have any powers ever to attack the constitutionality of a law?
I think that the legislature could do that if it chose to do that. I think that fundamentally you have the separation of powers and you have an attorney general as the chief legal officer of the state. It would be impractical for the legislature to do that.
Well, we had a case involving legislation of the Department of Public Instruction and said there was a core that you couldn't touch. The legislature could not touch because it was a constitutional officer and had certain powers.
Well, the Constitution creates the office. The office is there. The legislature can't abolish the office, certainly, but those duties are prescribed by law, and it's up to the legislature to make that decision. And I think this is about separation of powers, and it is about legislative prerogative. And the legislature responds to cases that are decided by this court. Once the public intervener case was decided, what did the legislature do? The legislature gave the authority to the public intervener to challenge the constitutionality of an act. That was a curative statute, in a sense, responding to the public intervener case. Later, the public intervener's position was abolished. the legislature at that point could have said, we are going to grant to the Attorney General the authority to challenge the constitutionality in circuit court in environmental matters. It did not do that. This is really about that legislative prerogative.
Well, would you agree that one of the core powers of the Office of Attorney General is to uphold the Constitution?
Yes.
That is a core power.
It has been recognized by this court as one of the, and by the Attorney General as one of their primary obligations to uphold the Constitution.
Okay, so if the legislature passes a law that is blatantly unconstitutional, must the Attorney General sit silently by if his duty is to uphold the Constitution?
If it is an act that is publicity juris or of such consequence to the state as a whole, the Attorney General could bring a case under its original jurisdiction, a case before this court under the original jurisdiction powers.
Why? Why can't he bring it in circuit court?
Because that rule was established as far back as 1908 in the case that was cited in the Court of Appeals, State versus Snyder, 172 Wis 415, 1920, talking about the Attorney General. He has no power to prosecute actions in circuit court except in cases remanded by the Supreme Court unless requested by the governor or either branch of the legislature or in cases specifically authorized by the statute.
Where is that in the Constitution or in the statutes? I know Snyder says that, but where is that?
I think it derives itself from what the Constitution says at the very beginning. The Attorney General has authority. Its duties are prescribed by law. And this court has said over and over again, prescribed by law says what the legislature grants to it.
Where does it say? Where is the legislation that says the AG can only come in on original action to this court?
The legislation doesn't specifically say that, but it also doesn't specifically grant to the Attorney General the authority to go in unilaterally into circuit court and contest constitutionality.
So why wasn't original jurisdiction, I guess I should probably ask Ms. Kloppenberg in this, but I'll ask you to speculate, why was this not brought as an original action?
Well, I think she acknowledges in her reply brief, I don't have the exact page, but in her reply brief, she acknowledges that this is a local matter. The argument on the constitutional issue is this is a local bill. It doesn't apply to the state as a statewide concern. It is a local bill. It would not be subject to the court's original jurisdiction. You can't argue it both ways. You can't say it's a local bill for constitutional purposes and then to say for jurisdiction purposes, original jurisdiction, that it applies statewide. It does not. So because it's a local matter, it is not a matter of original jurisdiction. The apportionment cases are a different matter. I mean, the apportionment cases go to the fundamental nature of what our government is all about. The apportionment cases say that the fundamental nature of people being represented equally in the legislature means that the Attorney General can contest the constitutionality of apportionment bills by way of original jurisdiction before the Supreme Court. That's fundamental to our government, to our democratic form of government.
But on page 6 of your brief, you state that there are several ways the Attorney General's concerns could be addressed. And you said, first, the Attorney General is authorized pursuant to 165 to ask this court to take original jurisdiction over such a challenge.
Theoretically. I don't believe that they could do that in this case because it's a local matter.
So you don't really mean in this case?
Not in this case. We're talking generally about when the Attorney General can challenge actions based upon constitutionality. Quo warranto, where there's a specific statutory authorization, apportionment, which has been recognized by over 100 years, and original jurisdiction. Let me just address the issue of authority under Section 30.294.
Before you get to that, I find troublesome the argument that it is inconsistent to say it is
both a local matter and also argue, as the state does, that it's a matter of great public interest. Can't there be a law, and I'm making this up, let's say, a law that focuses on the research of the University of Wisconsin La Crosse in cloning animals or in doing nuclear experiments? A legislation that is specific to a program at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. Arguably, it may be a matter of great public interest whether or not that department at La Crosse is doing nuclear experiments or is cloning some types of animals. So I don't see that to argue that it's a local bill, but it is also of great public interest, necessarily is inconsistent.
Well, I gave that answer in response to the question about original jurisdiction, and the cases that interpret original jurisdiction say that a matter could be publicly juris, could be a matter of some concern statewide, but if it's local in nature, and the Attorney General admits this in their reply brief, it's not simply our position, they pretty much acknowledge it, that this would not be a case for original jurisdiction on that basis, based upon the law that's of original jurisdiction. Section 30.294, let me just make it clear, it is our position that the Attorney General does not have authority to bring an action in this case under Section 30.294. I don't believe that's equivalent of standing, they just simply don't have a cause of action here. Section 30.294 says a nuisance exists if Chapter 30 is violated. No provision of Chapter 30 has been violated here. There are two ways that you can get a permit to put a structure in a navigable stream. One way is the DNR grants the permit. The second is you get a legislative exemption. Oak Creek obtained a legislative exemption. The legislative exemption granted by 30.056 means no violation. If there's no violation of Chapter 30, there's no nuisance, and therefore there's no basis to bring an action to abate a nuisance. I also wanted to touch on the practical implications of a court decision here that would overrule public intervener and grant to the Attorney General the authority to go into circuit court and challenge the constitutionality of acts.
Before you get to that, counsel, if you could address the sort of circularity of your last argument, which is to say that you don't have standing under 30.294 as any person authorized to abate a nuisance unless you establish a violation. In other words, the statute says that any person shall have the authority to bring a court action to abate a nuisance for a violation of Chapter 30. It's conceded that the Attorney General, or at least the Court of Appeals held that the Attorney General is conceivably any person within the meaning of this statute. The violation, your argument is, isn't there because the legislative exemption was granted, so there is no violation.
Correct.
So there is no nuisance, except the argument of the Attorney General is that the violation is established by the unconstitutionality of the exemption. But how does that get challenged if the Attorney General can't do it?
Well, I think that it gets challenged by some private individual. That's or a private group. That's what happened in the Gillen case that is cited in the Attorney General's brief, where the Friends of Nina Parks and the Clean Water Action Council of Northeastern Wisconsin stepped in to challenge a particular action. All we're saying is, based upon 100 years of case law, it's the Attorney General that the Attorney General cannot challenge the constitutionality.
As a practical matter, no private party is ever going to under the kinds of circumstances presented by this case, right? Because presumably Oak Creek is acting and channelizing the creek in what it perceives to be the best interest of the people of Oak Creek, so they're not going to mind.
Well,
some environmentalist do-gooder from another part of the state isn't going to have the wherewithal to bring the challenge, for example. So how is...
Well, my response to that would be if it's perceived as a serious enough violation and something that has significant ramifications environmentally, that there will be an environmental group, as there was in the Gillen case, that will step forward and challenge it. It is simply not the Attorney General's role to step into court challenging the acts of the legislature. And that's, I think that's the concern about the practical implications here. If this court were ruled that the Attorney General has such authority.
So we basically have the Attorney General in a case like this acting in the form of or in the way of a special prosecutor, to use a federal example?
Well, I mean, essentially that's what they're trying to do, but I think that in their attempt to do that, they're running contrary to certainly what they argued in Public Intervenor and what has been the status of the law for many, many years in this state. And to do otherwise, I think what you're going to find is that the Attorney General is going to find itself subject to intense lobbying, intense political pressure from various groups to step forward and to unilaterally, on their own, step into circuit courts around the state challenging the constitutionality of actions.
The matter with that?
I don't think that that's really the role of the Attorney General. That's not what's been recognized as the Attorney General's role by the legislature, which prescribes its duties, and by this court.
Well, you agreed that, it seems to me, you agree with Ms. Kloppenberg that whenever there's a constitutional challenge in an area of great public concern, that the Attorney General can step in. You would just limit it to original actions.
To original jurisdiction of the court, correct. I would not. I think that that's what the law says.
So you agree the Attorney General has that broad power. You would just have him bring all the cases here.
I think there's a very limited number of cases that would be subject to the original jurisdiction of this court. And unless...
Isn't any unconstitutional law of great public interest and concern?
Well, I think philosophically that there is, but this whole concept of great public concern wouldn't have arisen if there wasn't the differentiation between constitutional violations. If all constitutional violations were a matter of great public concern, this great public concern doctrine would never have arisen because that's intended to differentiate types of constitutional violations.
I think it relates to the original jurisdiction of this court. The original jurisdiction of this court is matters of great public concern.
Certainly.
So, say the AG can bring it here. I don't think... the Attorney General can bring other matters of constitutionality to other courts now.
Well, we have to keep in mind the various departments and agencies of the state have the right to challenge constitutionality under certain circumstances. If it's great public concern and if it doesn't involve two agencies. But that's if an agency brings an action and asks the Attorney General to represent the agency in that action. That's a different situation. And that's where this whole great public concern doctrine, I think, is very confusing. Because you have the Attorney General as its own entity, deriving its powers from the legislature, not the common law, where the great public concern doctrine has no applicability. Then you have the agencies, which are created by the legislature. The basic rule says you can't challenge the constitutionality of acts of its creator. But the exception to that that's been carved out over the years is the great public concern doctrine. But that doesn't apply in situations where you have, as in Columbia County, where you have a county and a state agency in court against one another. It only applies if you have a state agency, perhaps the DNR, and a private individual. That's how the courts have interpreted this great public concern doctrine. But it has no applicability in this situation where the Attorney General has brought this action on their own. I believe that in terms of the... I know a question was asked of Ms. Kloppenberg in her argument with respect to the issue of common law public nuisance. And just to make clear our position with respect to that, there is, again, our position is there's no statutory public nuisance because by virtue of section 30.056, there's no violation. A common law public nuisance brings into play a different subset of factors. And the chief case on common law public nuisance is the Quality Egg case, which is cited at page 36 of our brief. And it really involves a balancing of a number of factors: extent of harm, the character of the harm, the social value attached to the type of case or to the type of use, the suitability of a particular use to the character of the locality, none of which have been explored in this case. So I don't think that this court can really make a ruling with respect to the issue of common law public nuisance. It's our position that strictly on the basis of the public intervener case, this court can uphold the Court of Appeals decision, which essentially had the effect of dismissing the declaratory judgment action of the Attorney General. I would invite the court to look back to Judge Foley, even though that he ruled against us. I think if you look at Judge Foley's remarks, he was very troubled. He made the comment that he was very troubled about granting the authority, in this case, to the Attorney General to challenge the constitutionality of an act. His comment was he was concerned that the Attorney General would take that as carte blanche authority to a challenge constitutionality of a number of different actions. The other thing that I would be concerned about in terms of the practical implications of granting the Attorney General that authority is, where does that end? Does it mean that the Attorney General not only can challenge constitutionality of statutes in circuit court, but now are they able to challenge what they perceive to be unconstitutional conduct, if you will? Let's take the Supermax prison as an example. If, as I understand it, the practice there is to confine prisoners because of their criminal records, because of their criminal background and their conduct in prison, to solitary confinement 23 out of 24 hours of the day. Could the Attorney General say, we believe that that's unconstitutional, we're going to bring a circuit court action to challenge the constitutionality of that act? I think those are the kinds of dangerous implications with respect to if the Attorney General was given that authority based upon your decision in this case.
Is there any limit on the legislature's authority to either grant or withhold authority from the Attorney General to challenge statutes?
Well, I think, as always, it's the balance of powers, and the judiciary has the ability to constrain the legislature from adopting unconstitutional acts.
But we can't act unilaterally. We have to have somebody bring a case to us. That's, you know, in the proper limitation of our institutional role.
Right, and what we're saying is that the history of the case law in Wisconsin is such that the legislature has not granted that authority to the Attorney General to bring a case in circuit court. You've ruled that way. And if there are to be those challenges to what is perceived to be unconstitutional acts of the legislature, they have to be brought by private parties, by a state agency, with the Attorney General representing them, if they can determine it to be a matter of great public concern, or by the Attorney General in an original jurisdiction action before this court.
Can you help me with that, the latter argument? I mean, I see in essence your argument to be that the Attorney General's powers are statutory, that in Wisconsin the Attorney General has no common law powers.
Correct.
Well, then how can you get original jurisdiction? I also understand you to be arguing that if this kind of case qualified for original jurisdiction, they could be original jurisdiction challenging the constitutionality of the statute could be brought. Where is the statutory authority?
Section 14.11 grants the governor and the attorney general of that authority, and that's the authority that the Attorney General has relied upon in the apportionment cases. And it's very limited, but that's what they've relied on, the apportionment cases.
So your position is, to go back to something that you said a moment ago about the great public concern exception to the general rule against Attorney General authority to challenge statutes. Your position is basically that
The
DNR, for example, could have brought this challenge with the Attorney General representing it, and that would have been acceptable under Fulton, or at least they could have made the argument under Fulton that
it's an issue
of great public concern, therefore we have authority to challenge Oak Creek.
Well, I think the reason they didn't do it is because the great public concern doctrine, despite my colleagues' arguments to the contrary, is very clear that the great public concern doctrine cannot be invoked when it's an action between a state agency and a municipal government. And I believe that's why the DNR did not bring this action in circuit court with the Attorney General as its representative.
So your suggestion that a state agency act as the party to bring this issue into court and get it litigated isn't viable under these circumstances?
Not under these circumstances.
Okay.
And others where they proceed against a private individual, they could invoke the great public concern doctrine. Not here where it's against a municipality. I would urge this court to reject this unprecedented attempt by the Attorney General to assert its authority to challenge a constitutionality in circuit court under these circumstances where that authority has not been granted to it by the legislature. Thank you.
Under 14.11, and I'm just doing a quick read of it, I only see that the governor has the authority to ask the Attorney General to initiate the action, and not the Attorney General by himself or herself the authority to initiate any original jurisdiction.
Well, that it has been interpreted by the courts in the apportionment cases.
Okay.
that the Attorney General has that authority.
Even without the governor's request, huh?
Yes.
Hmm. Interesting reading of that statute.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Clappenberg, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few brief comments. First, I'm not one to usually argue against myself, but Section 165.25, Paragraph 1, does give the Attorney General the authority to appear on his own before the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. If the language is to appear for the state and prosecute or defend all actions and proceedings, civil or criminal, in the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court in which the state is interested or a party. Therein lies our statutory authority to come seek the court's original jurisdiction.
I'm having trouble hearing.
Therein lies
the statutory authority for the Attorney General to seek this court's original jurisdiction.
Yes.
On any matter in which the state has an interest. So, without a directive from, I'm sorry.
That's not with respect to the circuit court.
Correct.
So that authority comes again?
I have argued this, well, the circuit court authority comes from specific statutes like 30.294 or this combination of 165.25.9. Okay. The underlying claim is local to the extent that it's a local public nuisance, that if it hadn't already taken place, would require considerable fact-finding to determine whether, in fact, it was a public nuisance. It is also local because there is a two-part test to determine whether a bill is an unconstitutional local bill or not. The first part of the test is that the issue is of statewide concern. The second part of the test is that the direct impact is local. Here, although the ultimate impact is to public trust rights throughout the state because of the constitutional violation, but throughout this river system because of the specific public nuisance, nevertheless, the immediate impact, as found by the Court of Appeals, is only on this creek and on the fisc of the city of Oak Creek. And therefore, it is local in that respect, and the Attorney General went first to the circuit court because the essence of this claim is seeking an injunction of a local public nuisance. There are at least two ways to do something to the waters of the state. One is with a permit. Two is with nothing if what you're doing does not harm the interests of the state. Third is if the legislature has otherwise authorized it. As I noted in my brief, the Legislative Council notes, and those notes have been cited in other cases, indicate that this was meant to grandfather activities already allowed by the legislature. There are a number of, and I can't cite them today, but there are a number of specific projects that the legislature has allowed. There's some projects with respect to Lake Winnebago and some other, there may be three or four in Chapter 30, but they all are subject to DNR review or approval. They all reference the Chapter 30 standards. There is no delegation of public trust authority that takes any waterway completely out of the public trust Chapter 30 standards.
Could I ask you a question?
Sure.
I have some recollection about the authority of the Attorney General to file amicus briefs or intervene in a case. Say there's a case in the United States Supreme Court. What's the procedure for getting the state of Wisconsin as a friend of the court?
Because 165.25.1 is silent as to the federal court system, the practice of the Attorney General has been to get the governor's authority before appearing in federal court, whether as a party or as an amicus.
Wasn't there a case that said that the Attorney General had to do that?
I don't know if there was a case. The Attorney General did file an amicus, and it was determined subsequent to that that he could only do so at the request of the governor. I don't know if that was... I'm not so sure that was decided in the case. As to the inadequacy of the private citizen alternative, the Gillen versus Mina case is instructive. The plaintiffs there dropped their claim for injunctive relief in part because they couldn't post the bond. And so although they may, whether they succeed in their declaratory judgment or not, they can get no injunctive relief in that case. Finally, the issue of great public concern and standing are the two limits on whether a constitutional challenge by the Attorney General be allowed to proceed. Have nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kloppenberg. Thank you, Council. The act of concurrence.